So welcome, everyone. I am Linda Graham, and I'm co-teaching the 8-week Mindful Self-Compassion course with Jane Barras at Spirit Rock this fall. We just had our half-day silent retreat last Saturday. And I also teach resilience at Spirit Rock. I'll be teaching 5-day-longs or retreats in 2018 about resilience. And I teach resilience at other venues around the country as well, meaning how we bounce back from adversity, from coping with challenges and crises, recovering from disappointment and difficulty and even disaster. And there's been an escalation in the number and severity of disasters that people have had to cope with lately, and a deepening, at least I sense, of the existential dread about the safety and well-being of ourselves, our loved ones, our community, our country, and our world. So I incorporate practices of mindfulness, being aware of what's happening, and being aware of our reactions to what's happening, and practices of compassion and self-compassion, bringing kindness, care, concern to the person experiencing whatever is happening, and kindness and care for their reactions to what's happening, whether that's for ourselves or for another person. And besides teaching those pillars of wisdom in our tradition, wisdom and compassion, to help alleviate suffering and alleviate the suffering of suffering, coming into an equanimity that can hold the 10,000 joys, the 10,000 sorrows of our lives, I also teach the neuroscience of resilience, what the discoveries of modern brain science can teach us about cultivating our capacities for resilience, focusing on our capacities for response flexibility, being able to shift gears, shift perspective, shift points of view, shift our automatic patterns of response to whatever ups and downs we're facing in our lives. So, of course, mindfulness and compassion can be very helpful. They're very helpful in cultivating the clarity, the spacious acceptance, the disentanglement from previous perspectives and views that might be blocking or derailing our resilience, that might be preventing us from seeing what wise and wholesome action we might be able to take when we're confronted with a disturbance or a distress. So besides thousands of years in our Buddhist tradition of studying the nature of mind, and how our mind creates suffering or accepts and works with and lets suffering move through awareness, modern neuroscience is teaching us that the resilience or response flexibility is innate in our being human because it's innate in the human brain. And knowing that, I want to suggest 5 factors for response flexibility and then lead you in a meditation that might help you experience your own response flexibility when dealing with the suffering that we and all of humanity are vulnerable to experiencing. So the first factor is safety. And that doesn't mean that things are safe out there or that struggles with other people in our lives are resolved. It means that there is a perception, a neuroception of safety in the brain, meaning that our nervous system is not too revved up and it's not too shut down. Our body brain is actually resting in its natural baseline physiological equilibrium. We can be calm and relaxed, yet engaged and alert, as we are or hope to be when we're sitting on our meditation cushion, able to respond to whatever's happening with some inner equanimity. We can cultivate this equilibrium through many, many practices, including mindfulness, including self-compassion, and we can come to that equilibrium by engaging the brain's hardwired in social engagement system. Human beings are social beings, and our brains are social organs. And we regulate our nervous system by being in physical proximity with people we feel safe with. The brain perceives and processes, even unconsciously, signals from another person's facial expressions, body language, tone and prosody of voice, To use the message, it's fine, you're safe, you're okay, to soothe the anxiety and come out of numbing or collapse. So Barbara Fredrickson, who's a pioneer researcher in positive psychology, writes about how this could happen in her book on loving kindness, Love 2.0. When two people are in physical proximity, making eye contact, sharing positive emotions, offering mutual care and concern, the neurochemistry of the two brains begins to sync up. There's a neural synchrony between the two people that generates a feeling of what I would call safety and trust, and that she calls love. It's this neuroception of safety in the brain that primes the innate neuroplasticity of the brain, creating conditions for our learning and change. The second factor is the connection between people and the experience or memory of feeling held safe and secure, loved and cherished by other people. So one of my favorite quotes of all time is from my mentor, Diana Fosha. The roots of resilience are to be found in the felt sense of being held in the mind and heart of an empathic, attuned, and self-possessed other. And one of my favorite poems that I love to share is from the 19th century British novelist Dinah Craik. Ah, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh out thoughts nor words, but pouring them all right out just as they are, chaff and grain together, certain that a faithful hand will take them and sift them, keeping what is worth keeping, and with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. So there are many reasons, perhaps, why the Buddha answered Ananda's question, is Sangha half the holy life? With Nay Ananda, the Sangha is the whole of the holy life. But certainly the support and encouragement of being with like-minded, like-hearted people is a factor in strengthening our resilience and capacity to cope with the difficulties and dilemmas we face on a daily, if not hourly, basis. This support does happen when we're in physical proximity with safe, caring other people. But because whatever we can imagine is real to the brain, we can also call up memories of when we have felt safe and secure, been loved and cherished by others. And then a simple hand on the heart and remembering the feelings of those moments can activate the release of oxytocin in the brain. It's the hormone of safety and trust. It's the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So we can return to our baseline equilibrium that is the roots of resilience simply by remembering feeling safe and loved and cherished. The third factor is the cultivation of positive, pro-social emotions like kindness, compassion, gratitude, generosity, because those emotions shift the functioning of the brain out of contraction, reactivity, out of the negativity bias of the brain into more receptivity, more openness, more optimism. And the brain can shift gears, shift perspectives, shift views. These pro-social emotions that have been researched are very similar to some of the paramitas in this tradition that we can practice to move toward enlightenment: generosity, patience, loving kindness. So 25 years of data from neuroscience research is converging with 25 years of data from behavioral science research, dovetailing quite nicely, to show that a direct, measurable outcome of cultivating these positive, pro-social emotions is resilience. And that's not just a correlation, it's a direct cause and effect. So we can choose to cultivate positive emotions like kindness and compassion and gratitude, not just to make ourselves feel better, but so that we actually do better, more connected with others, more resilient. And this is part of the very real power of mindful self-compassion. The fourth factor is conscious reflection. And that really should come as no surprise to anyone here. By conscious reflection, I mean mindfulness as Guy Armstrong teaches, knowing what you're experiencing while you're experiencing it. Not thinking about the experience, but knowing what you're experiencing while you're experiencing it. As James teaches, Mindfulness is simply being aware of what is happening right now, without wishing it were different. Enjoying the pleasant without holding on when it changes, which it will. And being with the unpleasant without fearing that it will always be this way, which it won't. So this practice of conscious reflection or mindfulness, pausing and coming into presence, pulling out of distraction, denial, dissociation, showing up and engaging with experience as it is. Then noticing and naming our experience as it is. And I remember this story that Guy Armstrong teaches about himself. So Guy was on a three-month meditation retreat at IMS. And Guy is a very experienced meditator, but he was having trouble settling in. He was restless and not a happy camper. And so finally he realized and named, oh, this is despair. And not that he felt good being in despair, but naming what his experience was allowed him to settle into it and to be able to inquire into it and be with it. So this noticing and naming creates the space for acknowledging, allowing, tolerating, accepting our experience as it is in the moment. And that allows us to step back and disentangle and observe and reflect and do an inquiry. And that allows us to monitor and modify our experience, to actually monitor and modify our response to our experience and discern whether it is wise, skillful, effective, or not, and then to choose something else if necessary. And the fifth factor is that the brain learns best from small, incremental changes repeated many times, little and often, so that the neural circuitry has the time and space it needs to install the resource in long-term memory. This factor in the brain is partly why mindfulness and self-compassion both work so well to create changes in our perspectives and in our behaviors. Moment-to-moment experience repeated many times. So Richard Davidson, a psychologist, neuroscientist, founder, director of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a long, long-time Dharma practitioner, has done much of the research in this country on the impact of both mindfulness and compassion, and can show that they are two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to science, because they operate precisely how the brain processes information the best, little and often. So I would like to lead us in a meditation practice that may bring all of these factors together: safety, resonant relationships, positive emotions, conscious reflection, and moment-by-moment experience, little and often. This is the giving and receiving meditation, one of the core meditations of mindful self-compassion. It's also called compassion with equanimity. So I use this practice a lot when I'm actually sitting with my psychotherapy clients if they're having a rough time or distressed about something. And it's meant to be a practice that you do in real time, face to face with another person. It's usually taught as a guided visualization, so you imagine that you're sitting with someone who is experiencing some suffering or someone you deeply care about, and you want to offer warmth, kindness, goodwill, care, and concern. So because I know that you all are a fairly sophisticated group of practitioners, I would invite you to do this meditation practice with a partner if you wish. So you'll be turning so that you can sit face-to-face with a partner, or, if you wish, you can do this meditation on your own as a guided visualization. Both ways are fine. So if we'll take a minute if you want to work with a partner. It'll be done in silence, but you'll be sitting next to each other making eye contact for part of it. So you can turn your seats if you want to work with someone, or move around on your cushions if you want to work with someone. And if you want to do this as a guided visualization on your own, that is also perfectly okay. It works either way. So just take a moment for people to settle in with a partner if they want to do it that way. If you do choose to do it with a partner, turn so that you can sit and face each other directly so that you're comfortable sitting. You're not torquing your body to do that. So we begin with whether you're working with a partner or on your own. You begin by sitting comfortably, closing your eyes, even if you're working with a partner. Everyone, closing your eyes. Visualization is easier when your eyes are closed. And then take a few deep, relaxing breaths. Allow yourself to feel the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. And notice how your breath nourishes your body as you inhale and soothes your body as you exhale. Let your breathing find its own natural rhythm and continue feeling the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. And if you like, at any time, you can place your hand on your heart or any other place on your body that is soothing as a reminder to bring not just awareness, but loving awareness to your experience and to yourself. Become aware of any stress that you're carrying in your body. And inhale fully and deeply, drawing compassion inside your body and filling every cell in your body with compassion. So let yourself be soothed by inhaling deeply and by giving yourself the compassion you need when you experience discomfort. Now focus your attention on your in-breath, letting yourself enjoy the sensations of breathing in, one breath after another, noticing how your in-breath nourishes every cell in your body, even when you don't even have to think about that, and then release your breath. If you like, while you're breathing in, you can also carry a word on each in-breath, such as nourishing, or loving, or caring, or deep ease. You can also imagine inhaling warmth or light, whatever works for you. Give yourself whatever would feel compassionate to yourself in this moment. Now, if you're working with a partner, both of you open your eyes and gaze gently into each other's eyes. You may not know any specifics of this person's experience, whether there's any distress or suffering going on in the moment, but you can bring care and concern to your sitting with this person now, simply because they are a human being, and suffering is so much a part of the human condition. If you're doing this practice on your own as a guided visualization, bring to mind someone to whom you would like to send warmth and kindness and care and goodwill. Either someone you love or someone who is struggling and needs compassion. And visualize that person clearly in your mind. Now, everyone, shift your focus to your out-breath. Feel your body breathe out and send warmth and kindness and care and goodwill to your person, the partner that you're sitting with or the person you're working with in your imagination. With each exhalation, send kindness, care, goodwill toward this person. And if you like, you can add a kind word with each out-breath. Soothing or comfort or peace. Now feel your body breathing both in and out. Breathing in for yourself and breathing out for another. Nourishing for me, nourishing for you. Or soothing for me, soothing for you. Or whatever works for you. Eventually, you can simply say, one for me, one for you. One for me, one for you. And feel the breath of kindness flowing in and flowing out. As you maintain that rhythm, one for me, one for you, listen carefully to these words and let them gently roll through your mind. Everyone is on his or her own life journey. I am not the cause of this person's suffering, nor is it entirely within my power to make it go away, even if I wish I could. Moments like this are difficult to bear, yet I may still try to help if I can. One for me, one for you. Allow your breathing to flow in and flow out like the gentle movement of the sea, flowing in and flowing out. Let yourself be a part of this limitless, boundless flow of compassion, breathing in and breathing out. You can focus a little more on yourself or a little more on the other person, whatever you need. Breathing in for yourself and breathing out for another. Nourishing for me, nourishing for you. Or soothing for me, soothing for you. One for me, one for you. One for me, one for you. Feel the breath of kindness flowing in and flowing out. And listening again to these words, everyone is on his or her own life journey. I'm not the cause, or I'm not the entire cause, of this person's suffering. Nor is it entirely within my power to make it go away, even if I wish I could. Moments like this are difficult to bear, yet I may still try to help if I can. One for me, one for you. Then everyone close your eyes again. Gently bring your awareness back to breathing in and breathing out in this moment and in this place. And we'll take a few moments here to notice and reflect on your entire experience. When you're ready, you can open your eyes. Now we have a little bit more than the 10 minutes allotted in this Sangha for questions and answers and discussions. But I really, really do teach a lot through interaction with other people and answering questions. So please take a moment to see if you have questions about safety, about resonant relationships, about positive pro-social emotions, about conscious reflection, about the brain learning best little and often, about mindfulness and self-compassion, the exercise that we just did. If there was anything difficult about that meditation, or if anything worked especially well, and I welcome the exchange, the dialogue. So I guess we have a microphone? Yeah. Okay. So, please.
Thank you, Desiree. Mm-hmm. And thank everybody. I don't like talking into these things. Ice cream. So something that has been coming up for me recently is... or that I've been grappling with, is the distinction between mindfulness and compassion, because they seem like two distinct things to me. And yet, sometimes I hear it talked about, it's sort of collapsed into this one thing. And that doesn't sit well with me. So I'm just wondering how to tease that apart.
So in the Mindful Self-Compassion Protocol, they talk very specifically about mindfulness is awareness of our experience and our reactions to our experience. And self-compassion is bringing kindness or care to ourselves for what we're experiencing and for our reactions to our experiencing. So the awareness focuses on the experience, and the self-compassion focuses on the experiencer. And when we use the phrases in mindful self-compassion, the first phrase is, may I be kind to myself in this moment. That's the self-compassion phrase. May I be aware and accepting of this moment exactly as it is. That's the mindfulness. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment. That's the self-compassion again. Then may I give myself all the compassion and courageous action that I need. So that's when they start to bring together, because the mindfulness is part of our discerning what compassionate, wise, courageous action would be. So they're taught as separate processes with separate objects of awareness. But eventually in the practice itself, it does begin to blend together. It's an awareness that is a loving presence, as Tara Brach would say. So the compassion kind of warms up the mindfulness, and the mindfulness brings a clarity to the compassion so that we're not lost in our experience. So, was that helpful? Yeah, okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to talk about what I noticed from the experience, and that it just felt so balanced and so, like, circular. I noticed, I mean, for myself, you know, trying to have that sense of balance and equanimity is not easy, and sometimes I forget to give myself oxygen, you know, I forget to take the breath, and I'm a lot focused often on others, and so this exercise is just such a beautiful, I can't even really describe my feeling right now, but it's just such, it just felt so flowing and lovely and warm. It's really nice. Thank you.
So I would segue off of that. As the researchers study empathy in the brain and compassion in the brain, they see that two different parts of the brain light up. We don't use the same structures of the brain for compassion that we use for empathy. And so when we think of compassion fatigue, and many of us will be caregivers at some point for children or aging parents or professionally, we can burn out if they're renaming it from compassion fatigue to empathy fatigue, because the fatigue comes when we are with someone's feelings and we take them in and we take them on and we take them home, and we're feeling someone else's feelings, rather than keeping a slight separation. You're having your experience. I can attune to that. I can empathize with that. I can care about that. But it's not my experience. I'm a separate person, and I have my own experience. So the compassion practice allows us to have compassion for ourselves. That's my experience. And I can have compassion for you with your experience, but there's that slight differentiation that keeps us from burning out. And so, in fact, they find compassion actually gives people energy. Rather than feeling depleted by taking on other people's experience, when we practice compassion, we're actually energized because compassion motivates us to want to move, to act, to help, and that's energizing. So thank you for the question. Over here, please.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about distinctions between loving kindness and compassion. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I'm reading Davidson and Goleman's new book, Altered Traits,
mm-hmm, yeah.
And they talk about compassion being this great thing, but often they kind of interchangeably use a loving kindness meditation, loving kindness practice with compassion practice. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've heard them taught as distinct, and I'm hearing them now there and elsewhere kind of being mixed together or conflated perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And a related question to that, I guess, is...
Can I answer that one?
Sure.
Thank you. So, yes, loving kindness and compassion are seen as two different activations. Because loving kindness wishes well-being, happiness, safety, freedom from suffering to people because they're human beings. It's a wish for happiness. It's on the positive side of things. Compassion is practiced when there's suffering, when there's pain, when there's disturbance. And then we practice compassion to keep the heart open when there is difficulty. So the loving kindness is sent more in the direction of happiness and positive, and compassion is sent more in the direction of there's suffering, there's pain, there's difficulty, and keeping the heart open. Now, does loving kindness blend with compassion, or can compassion feel like being kind to a person as well? Yes, but that's the distinction. The motivation is slightly different, if that helps.
So the related question, I guess, then is, it seems like loving kindness practice, I mean, sitting formally and doing loving kindness practice or walking through a BART station and practicing loving kindness is to, you know, wish well for all beings. And compassion, sitting on a cushion or walking through a BART station and practicing loving practicing compassion, is kind of starts with an awareness of negative, I guess, in a sense.
The compassion starts with an awareness of negative.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
And it's kind of an interesting shift then to think of other people or to look at other people from a perspective of just, you know, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease, mm-hmm. or, you know, picking Jack's phrases, you know, may you be held in compassion, may your pain and suffering be eased, may you live with peace. It's kind of a different focus of looking at people and just wishing well-being or looking at people and kind of starting with an awareness of people's suffering.
So, I'll answer it this way. When we do mindfulness practice, and we practice mindfulness with various objects of awareness, so we're training the mind to pay attention to sensations, to pay attention to the breath, to notice feelings arising, to notice cascades of feelings, to notice thoughts and to notice patterns of thoughts and whole belief systems. But the purpose of the mindfulness practice on those various objects of awareness is to train our awareness, is to be able to rest in awareness regardless of what the object is, so that we have that spacious awareness that can hold anything. I think similarly with the loving kindness and the compassion practices, we have various objects of our loving kindness practice, right? Benefactor, dear friend, neutral person, all beings. And we can have various objects of our compassion practice. We think of different people, or we're in relationship with different people. But the point of those practices is to keep the heart open. It's the training to keep the heart open. We train our mind for awareness. We train our heart to stay open. In the face of someone we know, someone we don't know. In the face of joy, in the face of suffering, in the face of difficulty. So that's maybe why it gets a little slippery in there. Okay, I'll do compassion here and I'll do loving kindness there. But the point of it is to keep your heart open. And that's what we're noticing, whether this is actually helping me keep my heart open. And you, little and often, you know, you start with people where that's a little bit easier to do, to get that success of sense of competence in your practice, and then you... I really tried. I was on retreat last December, and we had had the elections, and I really tried. I got close to some of my near enemies, but I couldn't do it yet for Donald Trump. So we keep practicing, practicing, practicing with various objects. The point is to keep your heart open. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. Here and then behind.
Hi, somebody taught me that the words, I am sorry, are part of a compassionate practice in the sense of two people interacting and one person thinking that the cause of their pain and their suffering is another person, when it really may be their own stuff that they're reacting to, but they're maybe not that aware and they... need to put it off onto somebody else. And you could say, I don't accept that. That's not my stuff. That's your stuff or whatever. Or you can say, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry that you're feeling that way. I'm sorry that you're suffering. And so I love those words. I think those are very compassionate words.
So we have some complexity here.
Okay.
That, of course, we want to take responsibility for our own actions and the impact that our actions might have on other people. We also know that we're all heirs to our own karma, and we're all heirs to our own choices of behavior all along. So that's why what I was talking about earlier, the differentiation, you're you and I'm me, which is called theory of mind, that's what it's called. You're you and I'm me, and we're separate people. That allows me to care, to engage. I'm my own person. And so I take responsibility for how I might be impacting you. I ask you to take responsibility as well for your choices. So the I'm sorry in that context, when both people are taking responsibility, when both people have the strength of character to do that, then I'm sorry can be very powerful and very compassionate because it's acknowledging the suffering. What can happen sometimes is people want to scoot out of their responsibility and say, I'm sorry, really quickly to get it over with. Oh, I'm sorry. As though nothing had happened and there isn't any residue left to clean up or a repair to make. So I also teach forgiveness practice. And one of the tricky parts about being able to ask for forgiveness or to forgive another is that remorse has to feel genuine. Right, that's what leads to the opening of the heart and the forgiveness. And so when people get a whiff of, well, you're saying you're sorry, but you haven't changed your behavior, you don't really mean it, right? It can get sticky. So we try to unpack those layers. But again, getting to the sense of the genuine feeling in the heart of openness and caring for another person's suffering, taking responsibility if we had any part in it. Why I like the equanimity prayer that is part of this meditation is it says, I'm not the cause of your suffering, or I'm not the entire cause of your suffering. Right? We try to acknowledge that the other person has to take responsibility too. And there was one behind.
I'm wondering if you have any sort of like advice or basic guidelines for incorporating a self-compassion practice into daily life. I think that, you know, in modern times we are very busy and occupied and it might not always feel natural or like the most, for lack of a better word, efficient response. So I'm just wondering, like, for example, what you do to incorporate this practice into your life.
I have a story to tell about that. A couple of winters ago, there was a big storm in the Bay Area, and it blew out the power transformer on my block. So we had no electricity for 6 hours in January. So no heat, no lights, no stove, no refrigerator, no phone, no internet. And I was fine until the morning when I wanted to get on the internet and connect with my world. And I could notice myself getting really cranky and kind of belligerent, and I wasn't being very skillful. So I walked into my kitchen, and there's a magnet on my refrigerator that says, may I give myself all the compassion I need? And I go, oh yeah, I teach this stuff. So I go through the phrases, which I'll tell you in a moment. I say the phrases of the self-compassion break, and I can feel my brain open back out. I can feel myself coming out of the contraction and the negativity. And I go, wait a minute, I have internet at my office. That's 10 minutes away. And I tell that story because when I was in the suffering, I couldn't think straight. And as soon as I did the practice, I mean, just a couple of minutes, my mind opened up again and I could solve the problem. So we don't practice mindful self-compassion to solve the problem, but it creates the space in the brain where we can. So the basic self-compassion break is simply noticing something's off, something is not working, something's ouch. And putting hand on the heart or hand on the cheek, because the physical touch begins to activate the caregiving system. It begins to downregulate the stress. So hand on the heart, and then a moment of recognition. Ouch, this is hard, this is suffering. And what I say to myself these days is, I'm not happy, I'm just acknowledging I'm not happy. And then to say the phrases, the traditional phrases, may I be kind to myself in this moment, which interrupts the automaticity of the reaction. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment. And that is the key turning place. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment. May I give myself all the compassion and courageous action that I need. I teach that as a self-compassion break. When you notice there's any suffering, you can do that. But I also teach, check in as you go throughout the day. Is there any suffering here? And if there isn't, gratitude, and on you go. But if there is some suffering that you notice, then you stop and you do the break. So the way I suggest people get into it is to check in with yourself as you go throughout the day. How am I doing? Just presence. How am I doing? And if there's any suffering, may I be kind? May I be aware? May I accept? May I give myself compassion? You can do it in less than a minute. So by doing it little and often, it begins to become an automatic habit, right? And you begin to, ouch. It just begins to be an automatic reaction. Is that helpful? Yeah, okay. And then behind you.
Hi. I read recently that sometimes underneath depression is suppressed anger and resentment.
Absolutely.
And remind me of Alice Miller's work about anger. Mm-hmm. And so my question is kind of two parts. One is there any positive role for anger?
Yes.
Or is it something to be bypassed and avoided? And then the second part is does that question have a different answer as a psychotherapist versus Buddhist?
Okay. Well, now I may take us to the dedication of merit. We'll see. I wrote my book Bouncing Back because I had to reconcile being a psychotherapist and helping people strengthen their sense of self and being a dedicated meditator and learning how to let go of the sense of self. And they're both necessary. So I wrote the book trying to reconcile that. In terms of our emotions, these days, there's a wonderful book title. The title is better than the book, but the book title is The Upside of Your Dark Side. And it's about our emotions and the emotions that we think of as negative or destructive, anger, rage, hatred, fear, sadness, whatever we might consider as negative. And now, psychology researchers, anyway, are understanding that every emotion has a positive purpose. Every emotion has an adaptive action tendency. Every emotion is a signal. Pay attention, something is happening, it's important, you know, pay attention. So anger is seen as the energy that allows us to protest injustice, betrayal, oppression, cruelty. Anger is what allows us to move against those negative forces. Anger, once we get that signal to move, then we can feed the anger with stories. We can feed the anger with patterns that we've learned from the past. We can feed the anger if we don't know what else to do, if we don't know how to let it move through and take different action. But anger and any emotion is seen as having a practical purpose to it. Anger, in fact, will activate people often out of depression, out of shame. It's more empowering to feel angry than to feel depressed or to feel ashamed of something. So there's ways that we learn how to use the anger to get the energy moving, but then to channel the energy in a constructive, compassionate even way. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Yes, please.
Hi, Linda. I had a chance to be at your day-long a couple of years ago in Spirit Rock, and you and I sparred about what am I to bring up right now. A follow-up to that question about anger, I think we are very privileged here to be in a monastery and to reflect about who we are, or whosoever comes to your practice and pays that money and sits there and learns and grows. I think about the thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who have been damaged by war and by displacement, and this is the future generation that we're going to be witnessing. How do we teach those people a different kind of resilience, because they're full of anger and resentment and have experienced great injustice? How are they going to raise their children in a way that those children are not PTSD legacies, that they're able to function in the world and know what compassion and love is? How are we going to teach those people in a very practical way other than talking to them?
Well, you're asking many, many deep questions here. And you're edging into the whole territory of trauma and PTSD. And so some of the research now in trauma shows that when people have awareness and acceptance of reality, so mindfulness is very helpful, when they have the resourcing of other people, and sometimes people are afraid to trust other people, but when there can be the resourcing of other people, even people who've gone through the same upset or trauma that you have, but people who can understand your experience out of common humanity. Counterintuitively, when people can find anything positive, even in the midst of difficulty and tragedy, which is why one of my favorite stories is when the refugees had to come out of Cambodia and they were in refugee camps in Thailand, they would have 2 square feet of earth in front of their tent and they would plant seeds, right, to find anything positive in the destruction around them. So a warm cup of coffee, a smile, playing with a puppy, walking in nature, anything that helps the nervous system come out of the trauma. The fourth one is being able to tell the story of the trauma, and Brené Brown will say to the people who've earned the right to hear it, so that you can come to a, there was a before and then this happened and then now there's a future, there's some place this is going, so that you're not stuck in the story, so that the event takes place in a larger life narrative. And then the hardest one is appreciating new growth, new life, new understanding, new choices, new possibilities because of what's happening and not just in spite of it. So there's a lot of work to do to help people. You know, I began my talk with safety. The first thing is safety, period. People have to feel safe in their physical body and in their mind and heart. I heartily recommend the film The Human Flow by Ai Weiwei, which is about the refugee crisis that we're facing. 34,000 people a day leave their homes. 34,000. There's millions, more than any time in our history since World War II. So to help people have a sense of safety when they're homeless is really the high art. And then the looking someone in the eye and having mutual care and getting that flowing, having the positive emotional experiences and the conscious reflection. So I think we start with ourselves, but then certainly our communities and the world that we're engaged in. And it's a stretch, but having some compassion for the people who are so full of confusion and fear and hatred that they cause war, that they cause oppression, that they cause that kind of misery. Seeing the humanity even there. It's a tall order. It's a tall order. But I think we cultivate our practices, you know, the four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity is the one that holds them all. So to have a comment?
No, I just asked because recently I started working with some Syrian refugees here in the Bay Area, and it's incredibly difficult. And I experienced a lot of helplessness, and I'm very resourceful at helping people as a teacher myself. And sometimes when people have gone through such a traumatic experience, the to get them to trust you and to get them to listen to you. It's very, very difficult. And I, you know, as a student of history, I'm just looking at the big picture where we're going to be 50 years from now with all these legacies that we're creating.
So the one thing I would suggest, and then we'll close into the dedication of merit, is to help people trust themselves. Help people trust themselves, their own capacities, their own resilience. They got this far. They got to Berkeley, you know. So helping them trust themselves and whatever courage, dedication to their own family, the survival instinct, they've got something going. Help them trust themselves and flower that. One on one. So, the dedication of merit, and I'm not sure if I'll do this exactly the way it's done in the Sangha, but if we take a moment to reflect on the sincerity of our own intention to deepen in practice, to steady our awareness, to strengthen our compassion, to remember to practice when we get caught up in the tasks and concerns of our day, and then to dedicate any merit from that practice to ourselves, to our own wise effort and intention, to the people that we know and love and care about, to the people that we don't know, but we know we want to care, to the many, many people that we're connected to in common humanity, simply by being human beings, and to all the people we know that are not named on these cards, but we care about their struggles and their suffering, and deepen our practice to be able to hold with a heart as wide as the world the suffering within it. Blessings on your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.